Hello, I'm Simon Burton, and welcome to Arts Roundup, where we'll take a skate across the tiles in Cambridge to discover an artist's gallery that's inside a car, how the city's exotic plant life can take us in new directions, gather up some untold stories of remembrance, and take a brief retrospective taster from Black History Month. In this edition, sculptor and poet Alexandra Drysdale reconciles some of life's opposites at the Sedgwick site as art language location hits the streets. The university's botanical garden's Juliet Dade previews its forthcoming Voicing the Garden oral history project. Cambridge poet and painter John Lyon celebrates Black History Month with his large canvases at a show in Bury. County Council historian Sally Ann Greensmith talks on the Great War Between the Lines Remembrance Project that launches a new online archive marking both recorded and untold stories circa 1914. And Cambridge Art Salon casts a seasonal spell, inviting local kids to get drawing on a Halloween theme. If you've ever felt frustrated in your daily life when sitting in your car when you travel but never really seem to get anywhere, or perhaps read endlessly and never seem to make any personal progress, you need to pull over and turn the whole problem around with some new art language thinking. That's the starting point for a piece of language-focused art that's one of the many exhibits currently on the Sidgwick site as part of Art Language Location series Exploring Text and Place. I dropped in to meet sculptor and poet Alexandra Drysdale, who decided to turn her family car into a poetic gallery and sculpture space, which you just jump into to witness the exhibits at close quarters.
Well, I thought it was a really interesting idea to do an exhibition where I was trying to combine kind of image making with language. So that was a kind of a new thing really for me.
And it's very much about language in a particular place, isn't it?
Yes, well it is. It's all in my car, my Toyota Corolla.
This car is your family car, but you've done something rather extraordinary. Can you describe the inside of it and what it is you've done with it?
Well, I said that I've converted into an artist playpen. So there are dollies, there's poems that I've written onto the back of the seats and the doors. There's various things hanging from the ceiling, and I've made a sort of highway along the windscreen area.
Basically, you've used your car as the paperwork for your poetry.
I have, yes.
I mean, we've got on the back of all the seats wonderful texts. Perhaps you'd like to read one for me. This one, I once loved Sufi.
Yes, okay. I once loved a Sufi, but he smoked too much grass. I once loved a Buddhist who spent too much time sitting on his arse. I once loved a Jew, but he attacked me with a knife. I once loved a Christian, but he wouldn't leave his wife. Now I love a centaur, the body of an animal from the waist down, the torso of a nobleman. He likes to walk barefoot, but I'm afraid of removing my shoes, of feeling the earth under my feet and my head in my toes. But this way, love gets grounded and made more profound. Not that airy, fairy, merry-go-round. I used to go to church to receive the bread and wine, but now I stay at home to be touched by the divine.
Wonderful. This is a script written down the back of the seat of the car. And also in the car, you have lots of mind-boggling objects. You've got a white hand stuck to the steering wheel. You've got small, what would you call them? They're dolls or mannequins?
Yes, they're dolls, really. Yes, a man and a woman doll with a brain kind of hanging between them, with rather confused, anxious-looking figures hanging off it.
And also a mobile in the middle of the car. This car is quite an adventure to get inside, because there are so many different things in here, and there are scripts, there are texts on the doors, on the backs of the seats, on the upholstery, all beautifully written in white paint.
Yes.
Did that take you a long time to put together?
That did take me a long time. I mean, the whole thing is actually, I'm surprised at how much I did just in a couple of months, in fact. So, yeah, there's a lot of work here.
And why not use a car for that purpose? It's absolutely wonderful. Now, the language of art is a key thing for you, isn't it? Can you explain how that works?
Well, yes. I mean, principally, I'm fascinated in images, but combining words with images is a whole really new thing for me, and it adds an extra dimension to it for people. I think it draws people in more. Often images can be quite kind of sometimes difficult to connect with, and somehow having words as well, obviously people relate to words very, very quickly compared to an image, so it kind of holds people's attention, I think.
Do you think there's a new kind of meta-language coming to talk about art which fills that gap?
I think there probably is, yes. I think hopefully this exhibition, Art, Language, Location, will do quite a lot to add to that.
Mm. The themes that run through your artwork, themes of spirit, matter and nature. Tell me about those.
We're trying to find a kind of connection that links these different aspects of being a human being and using my imagination and playing with materials to try and find those kind of links, really. Mm.
And reconciling opposites is another thing.
Yes, that's a big thing for me, reconciling opposites. Mm. Yes, in fact, I say that in my manifesto, which is written on the inside of the driver's car, driver's door.
What does that mean? Basically, that opposites don't have to disagree, that they can be amicable.
Yes, exactly. Mm. They can come together and produce, kind of create a space for a third way, as I say.
Mm. And you have a certain kind of humour that you like to get across in your work.
Yeah. I do, yes. A kind of cheeky, tongue-in-cheek humour, slightly kind of dark, and that the humour enables me to express something dark and kind of get away with it. And so
I've been having a look on your website that you do things like lectures.
Yes, I do.
So tell me a little bit about Out of the Blue, Red Vibrations and Way to the Wedding.
Oh, right. Well, I got into kind of lecturing on art history just as a way to support my art practice, really, but I'm fascinated in it. And so some of my lectures are just about the way artists use colour, but also I've got lectures on how artists portray and kind of explore the elements, earth, air, fire and water. Mm. Yeah.
And Gaston Bachelard was a big influence on you. Why
was
that?
I suppose he talks about the kind of poetic imagination, which is really, for me, you know, the kind of fundamental thing in the art practice.
You park this car, which is quite an interesting spectacle, in just outside the law faculty at Cedric site, on the pavement, and you're inviting people to come and have a look at it and sit in it and read the poems.
I am. It's quite difficult to get people to stop here because everyone's kind of on their way to a lecture. So I'm trying to kind of lure them here, but they're rather tentative actually at the moment.
Well, what's been the reception so far to the events of Art, Language, Location? I mean, it's something that was launched only last week and there's lots of things going on.
I think it's been great. You know, Robert Good, who's kind of set the whole thing up, has been, you know, marvellous at kind of getting everyone together. I think it may be a new kind of thing that's going to happen every year in Cambridge. I hope so anyway.
Fantastic. For you as an artist, I mean, do you have a lot of trouble in terms of finding places to exhibit your work?
I do. I mean, that's why, you know, getting hold of using my car as my own little kind of mini portable gallery is a way to deal with that. So I hope maybe in the future I can set up a kind of tour of the British Isles, taking my car to various places and opening it up for the public.
And how long is it going to be here?
It's just here until November the 2nd.
And where's your next exhibition? Where are you appearing next, as it were?
My next exhibition? Ooh, I don't know. I'm actually currently working on a project with another artist, Ernie Dalton. We're producing a sculptural performance work inspired by Nicolas Poussin's painting Dance to the Music of Time, and our aim is to perform it in the Wallace Collection, where the painting is hanging.
Fantastic. Alexandra, thank you very much indeed for talking to Cambridge 105.
Thanks a lot, Simon. It's been really good fun.
Cambridge University's Botanical Gardens is a spectacular resource that marks the city apart from others in being able to offer a comprehensive display of exotic plant life from around the world, even in winter, and has surprising things to discover as a legacy of the Darwin and pre-Darwin era. For over a century, historians and botanists have painstakingly looked after and catalogued one of the most important gardens in England. But there's one area the green fingers have hitherto missed. The whole story of what actually went on in the gardens over the decades from its many visitors. A new project, Voicing the Garden, is being launched, recording people's personal experiences and artworks inspired by people visiting the botanics, and will feature a screening of animations and film at the Arts Picture House on December the 11th and 12th, made by school children with the help of Cambridge Film Consortium. Voicing the Garden, an oral heritage project, will invite the public to contribute to any aspect of fleshing out the Botanic Gardens' past story and will use old film footage, documents and photographs as a starting point for creativity and history building. Development Officer Juliet Dade introduces the project.
We're trying to bring together both sides of the garden fence, as it were. We want to talk to people who have made the garden, people who have grown up in the garden, people who have simply visited and enjoyed the garden, all in the interest of trying to build up a picture of those parts of the garden that are stable and permanent and reassuring, but also building up a real picture of change over the decades.
The botanics has an extraordinary past, doesn't it? Because it sort of it began during Darwin's era, effectively, of exploration and gathering things
from all over the world and bring them together. So that's going to be part of it as well, isn't it? Would it be history, poetry and personal memories? Or
the garden does go back, in fact, to before Darwin's time. It was founded on its current site by John Henslow, who was Darwin's mentor and teacher. And indeed, there's a whole sort of developing thesis that Henslow, as the older man, was the person who gave Darwin his incipient ideas about variation between species. And if you come round the garden now, you can still see Henslow's extant tree plantings, which begin to show real variation. So you'll get the extremes in the forms of two black pines. They're both black pines, but one's from Austria, one's from Spain, and they look very different in the form. And we're beginning to sort of think that that is a deliberate teaching illustration and aid, which is, you know, there for us still 150, 160 years later. So that's one of those lovely historical stories that's coming out. But also what we're really interested in is that sort of personal side of things. So who came with their grandparents? Who came as little children? Who came and, you know, loved the bamboos? Because that gives us at the garden a whole different spin on how to understand and experience and enjoy the garden. You know, I've already gathered in stories that with my team of volunteers, you know, who've been fully trained in all this, about how, you know, those giant Wellingtonias are not giant Wellingtonias, really. That's where the tigers live, or something like that. And that's something that we're really loving getting to know. But yes, I mean, the whole project really came about because our longest serving member of staff, Al Langley, brought in one day a cine film from 1953 of an annual institution that still happens, which is called Round the Garden Race, which is really our staff party. And it was beautiful. You could see all these, you know, to me, I've been here a decade or more, but even so, you know, these were just names. These were legends in my lifetime. You know, Bob Younger, who was superintendent here, John Gilmore, who I think was probably one of our most inspirational directors from the 1950s to 70s. And to see them on film and running the race and then seeing how the garden has changed. You know, the paths were in different directions and the glasshouse range looked very different. We still had the teak palm house and now we have, you know, the replacement aluminium frame glasshouse that we put up in the 80s. You know, so it was wonderful to kind of see that film. And it, talking to Al, who's been here for 40 years, you began to understand that, you know, horticultural practice had changed, the landscape had changed, our attitude to visitors and being open and access had all changed. And it was wonderful to start to see that coming out.
Now, you've got films, but you also have other archive things like photographs and records and things like that. And with, like many other projects like this, presumably you're going to try and extrapolate and add to what you have to build from the skeleton and flesh out the whole past of the gardens. Is that right?
It's incredible how it's grown. So it started with, you know, just thinking, well, it'd be good to get up, you know, to gather up some of these stories and interview some of the people who've worked here, because there's an awful lot of information in heads, but not down on paper anywhere. And then it started to grow as we started to talk to some of the people. We had photographs sent in. We had a work diaries sent in. We've had slides sent in of how we've kind of reorganized the glasshouse range. So that sort of started to come out into a sort of multimedia approach. And then we had other films come in and we remembered that people would have filmed when the Titan arum flowered and, you know, in 2004, I think that was, and people had extraordinary memories of that. So it's really kind of expanded out and increased our resource.
And what about love stories? Have Cambridge's poets written things about the gardens? And has anyone ever proposed in the gardens on record?
Oh, well, wow, that's a great idea. I would love to know that. Maybe your listeners could tell us all about that. I do know that actually very recently a couple came down. It was incredibly well orchestrated with the help of our visitor services team here. And only about 4 or 5 months ago, there was a successful engagement in the garden, which involved looking after someone's champagne in our staff fridge for a while. And they had met as students here and came on their first date here. And, you know, 10, 15 years later, they were coming back down, I think from Newcastle, you know, to kind of remember their first date. And he popped the question. But I would love to know if there are other stories like that out there.
Now, a little bit about some of the key attractions to the garden for anyone who's listening who doesn't actually know. You do have a fantastic variety of things here. Wonderful hothouses full of huge plants with massive leaves. You've got dry gardens, wet gardens, shrubberies, lakes,
and so on and so forth. What are the sort of key few things that you would recommend that people come and have a look at?
Well, you're absolutely right. We do like to think that you've got basically the whole world in a garden on your doorstep. So, you know, you can go from mountainous plants to rainforest plants to, you know, deciduous woods. And of course, at this time of year, coming into the autumn, it's really the autumn colours which are beginning to get going. So our tree collection, one of the best in the eastern region, just beginning to colour up. We've got the beautiful liquid amber down by the lake. The birches are all golden. The black walnut has turned into a golden walnut. And there's a wonderful thing called the katsura tree at the moment, which is shedding its leaves. And as it sheds the leaves, the chemical change in the colour actually also emits this wonderful smell of toffee. So you can be walking around the garden and you suddenly think, I can smell caramel. What's that? Well, that's the katsura tree. So the trees are fabulous at the moment. Particularly, there are lots with berries and fruits. All the lovely crab apples are colouring beautifully. And then we've got some very unusual trees, like the Osage orange, which has these big lurid green tennis ball sized fruits, but they're all wrinkled, and we within the staff call them pickled gardener's brains, and a bit of autumn wind and that will bring them down, and they're really fun.
How can people get involved? Have you got a program online or something?
Well, we've got two things ongoing at the moment. We are gathering up recorded interviews, so I would love to hear from any of your listeners who have stories of how they've used the garden, what it means to them. Have they used it for solace, as a sanctuary, as a exercise ground, as an introduction to the natural world? We want to understand exactly how visitors use the garden and what they love about the garden. So if they get in touch with us, perhaps via your website, Simon, then we can we'll set up that interview between the person and some of our recorder volunteers who've been fully trained in the process. And then later in December, what we will be doing is launching a website to share some of these stories, so people can listen to them and understand more and explore more about that kind of texture to the garden, that context to the garden. But the website will also be encouraging you to participate. So you could upload your own photos of time in the garden. You could upload your own memories of time in the garden. It's basically a visitor book idea. So you can, but there is going to be a specific creative writing area to it, because we know that the garden is very inspirational for all sorts of amateur and professional writers. All sorts of poetry has been inspired by the garden, short stories by the garden, that kind of thing. And so what we've done is we've put together a kind of word workshop area of the website where local professional writers have talked about how they've used the garden for inspiration and for practice and for exercise, and they're putting together some exercises like how to use metaphors and that kind of thing, so that people can really hone their skills. And then once if you are inspired and you're happy with your piece, then we would be pleased to publish it on the website as well.
Jeanette, Dave, what a fantastic project. Thank you very much indeed for talking to Cambridge 105.
My pleasure.
In 1948, some 65 years ago, a ship called the Windrush arrived at Tilbury Docks, signalling the beginning of post-war mass migration to the UK. This October has been Black History Month in the UK, celebrating the achievements and cultural contributions of migrants since the Windrush docked. I decided to visit the winner of the Windrush Arts Award, John Lyons, a poet and painter from Trinidad and Tobago, as he exhibited his new and larger canvases at the spacious new Apex Gallery in Bury St Edmunds. I found his love of folklore and classic tales a best witness both visually and verbally together.
Time for feasting, a desperate love for survival, his gently puncturing kiss like a lover's. He conspires with a right moon to conjure up the world of folklore before the moon hides in dark grey folds of clouds. The ritual of the woo. There is a turbulence of flesh, a shaping of jaw, lengthening of canines, knees crooking back, feet become paws, armed with talons. His air nuzzling savors heifers. In pastures, they topple their bulk off a pale, stretched bellies.
Yeah. And I believe this last one.
Your work is very much based on folklore from Trinidad and Tobago, yeah, isn't it?
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about some of the things that you've got on show here? Because they're absolutely huge, colourful canvases, but they have a story behind them, don't they?
Well, yes, there are stories behind them because, I mean, the whole business of folklore, Trinidad folklore and Tobago folklore, have come down from a sort of what you might call a French Creole culture. And a lot of the characters there, they've got, you know, sort of French names. For instance, La Diablesse. La Diablesse is a devil woman. And she actually she takes revenge on men who actually think they're God's gift to women, you see. She might have suffered in the past by some broken up love affair. And she's actually now taking her revenge. And there's a lot of stories about her.
We're talking about spirits, retribution from the supernatural.
Oh, yes, yes. In fact, it's something we are in Trinidad and Tobago. We're very much aware of what we call the numinous, you know, that other world, if you like, parallel universe, if you like, of spirits and whatever. You know, that's what we're aware of all the time. And it's part of our culture. Mm. It's come down from our culture.
Now, you've got images, like an absolutely huge canvas there, which has apparently a figure of the crucifixion. But it's not the crucifixion in a Christian sense. It's with this wonderfully colourful background, which completely changes that, doesn't it?
Where did that come from? Trinidad is really a Catholic country.
Yeah.
It's been conquered by the Spanish. Yeah. And the Spanish is Catholic. They were Catholic. And so therefore, there's a lot of the Christian, which might be the word mythology, if you like, in our culture. And I wanted to capture that moment when Christ on the cross, his human nature was crying out, you know, because, you know, this we know that there's a divine nature and a human nature. And that moment, to remind people that, you know, that's what I wanted to see.
When the two things kind of meet in the mouth.
Absolutely
wonderful. And you fill lots of your canvases with extraordinary creatures from folk and mythical. Some of them look quite frightening. Some of them wear masks. Some of them are small and some of them are huge. Where do those come from?
Well, the mask part of it also is part of carnival.
Yeah.
Because in carnival, all the masks have come from not only the African culture, but it's also in the masquerade, but it's also part of what of carnival. And people wear masks all the time. And if you like, it's like a visual metaphor, really, you know, for really people are trying to conceal their real natures.
Mm. Do you think people should be afraid of their dreams or should take advantage of their dreams?
No, I don't think people should be afraid of their dreams, although some of them might be frightening when you call them nightmares. Yeah. But as an artist with a creative bent, you use all those avenues, if you like, of dreams and so on. And I'm very fond of surrealist painting anyway, surrealist and the expressionist painting. So they fit very well together in my work, in the way I work.
Can we talk about some of the specific figures from your dreams that are well recorded in the folklore of where you come from?
Yeah.
La Diablesse, Papa Boise, Lupicu and Soucoyon.
Well, yeah.
Are they pronounced right? Probably
well,
not.
Yeah. There's Soucoyon, which is a vampire.
Yeah.
It's sort of, she becomes a ball of fire.
Mm.
What she does, she's old during the daytime, she walks around as an old lady, right? And the reason why she disguises herself as an old lady is because people have, in my time anyway, people were very polite old people.
Mm.
So what better place to be but to pretend to be an old lady, right? But at nighttime, she takes the skin off, put it somewhere cool, becomes a ball of fire. Flies around at night like a vampire to suck people's blood.
And that sounds as though it has similarities with obviously Greek goddesses who take on other forms and play tricks upon people
absolutely,
and do things like that.
And
she's that kind of figure.
Yes, yes.
I see that you've got a very big canvas just up here on the wall of a person who apparently is strolling along with their head in the clouds reading a book.
Mm-hmm.
Where did that come from?
Well, that actually is very interesting. Because that person really is my alter ego.
Yeah.
You notice he's a bit of a clown. He's got a sort of a fool's cap on his head. And he has a book. That book is his poetry. His head above the clouds. Because, I mean, when you say you have your head above the clouds, it means that you're dreaming. But to be there with your head above the clouds, you've got to have your feet firmly on the ground. Now, that is, you've got to stretch pretty high.
Comic images come into it just as much as spooky images,
don't
they?
Oh, yes, definitely.
So that humour is tied in through all your art and your poetry.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's, in Trinidad, we humour is a great, great thing. We love humour anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And we make good use of it in every respect. Let words be the arbiter of my feelings, their imprisonment in this poem, my plea for reconciliation with reason. images like a hurricane in my mind, a topsy-turvy, dizzying, howling like the nocturnal lugaroo at a Caribbean full moon. I lie awake eyeballing lunacy, pardonable state, they say, merely a comic interference on the mind's perceptions, the moon's prankish glow inducing strange poetry. I should not be locked up for this poem.
You're listening to Arts Roundup on Cambridge 105.
The social devastation of the Great War has only recently slipped out of living memory, and marking its 1914 centenary in 2014, a new European-funded county council project is being launched to catalogue every aspect of its local history. The Great War Between the Lines project, linked to schemes in France and Belgium, will gather archive material and seek to tell hidden histories from every angle online and bring events into fresh perspective using material uploaded and contributed by the public. Hinchingbrook House, a regional troop training centre in 1914, will host a day of military enactments, mock battles and costume drama and hospital scenes on August the 3rd next year to show how people lived in the era. County Council Project Assistant Sally-Anne Greensmith previews the project, which is gathering steam.
We're holding an event on November the 11th this year in Cambridgeshire Archives. There'll be a 2-minute silence at Shire Hall at 11 o'clock, and then after that the archives will be open and there'll be original documents on display from the war period. There'll also be advice on tracing ancestors and local history in the First World War period, and we'd just love people to come in and share their stories. If they've got any memorabilia, bring it in and we'll have a look and see if we can advise them about it.
Other things that people would just think crumbs, that's incredible, you know, when they look through those. Are there particular ones that you can call to mind? Or
I think the thing is it's just so powerful actually reading people's letters from the time. I've read letters from the start of the war when they're so sort of confident and excited, and just knowing what comes, it really affects you when you read them. I think one of the most interesting things I found studying on this while I've been doing this project is the Belgian refugees. Such a huge influx of people came in such a short time, and how they were accommodated and how society sort of help offer them hospitality is really interesting.
But they saw war at the outset as a kind of adventure, didn't they? And yet a modern war was just pure carnage.
They just weren't ready really for how it was so quickly going to advance. Technology was just going to totally change the nature of warfare. And it's really interesting reading letters from the start of the war and then reading letters that date from that later period, sort of after conscription, people who've gone in, and it's a much different sort of tone, and you can see the toll that the war's taking on people.
And obviously anybody who didn't volunteer to go was between a rock and a hard place, weren't they, socially?
Yeah, definitely. We'll hopefully have some conscientious objectors material on display on November the 11th as well. So we want to look at sort of every aspect. We don't want to forget those people who took a different stand against the war. And I think it will help people sort of think about the Second World War as well, and the people that are still surviving from that. The fact that it'll encourage people to record those stories before they're lost. It was such a big event, but I still younger people around today that don't know so much about it, I don't think it's been overworked. I think there's definitely time to bring these stories back again. I mean, the Great War had a huge impact on society and sort of every aspect of it, and that's what we really want to look at with this project. We want to sort of not just look at the front line and what was happening in, on the battlefield, but also look at how it was affecting society at home and in the home front.
Because it basically took away an entire generation of young men, didn't it, from Britain, and left a society that was effectively gutted by what happened.
And I think because it was so devastating as well, it was one of the things it couldn't really be talked about at the time. I think that's why it's one of those things, sort of the point of our project is to uncover hidden stories, and I think it was one of those things that a lot of families sort of put to one side, and I think now it's time to sort of revisit it.
And how are you going to manage that?
We're running a series of touring exhibitions, and the whole point of those exhibitions is to pick different themes that perhaps won't have been looked at before. This project, it's been run in cooperation with European partners. So we've got various partners in Northern France and Belgium who've each picked a theme that they think might have been neglected, just family or the role of music. The exhibition, I think, is actually going to be on sort of the roles of the mother, father and the child, and looking at sort of the impact on those, looking at images and toys and things that were around for children, looking at the sort of things mothers would have had to cope with, like suddenly being having to support their family when while their partner's away. That's what that's trying to pick up on. Our website they're asking people to contribute material to has a section for people who want to upload things to do with culture and things. I think one of our partners is doing tourist routes sort of based around works of the poets that's quite well known.
So that would be people like Wilfred Owen.
Wilfred Owen, Wilfred Sassoon, Rupert Brooke.
So you'd be asking people to contribute to a website bank of material, will you? And then I mean, backing that up with archive material and things like that.
Yes, we've got a website on the Cambridgeshire Community Archive Network. And so anyone can submit material to that website. It's already got things uploaded that were already on the archive network, plus things that we found on our research and things that people are already starting to contribute themselves.
What about things like the culture of the era, the songs, music and things like that? Are those going to be part of it as well?
One of the touring exhibitions is the theme is music. So there will be a whole exhibition looking at how music was used for propaganda, how it changed, how the messages it was sort of presenting about the war changed through that period, how sort of musicians in that time were influenced and how military music that was used in campaigning and recruiting people. Well, because our project is running up till the end of September next year, we're really focusing on sort of raising awareness of the centenary and encouraging people to get thinking about it now, trying to improve access to sort of materials and information about researching the war in Cambridgeshire archives and local studies. And we just feel like we're starting the ball rolling and wanting to sort of raise awareness and help sort of publicise things that people are doing, help people coordinate things for the centenary.
Yeah, fabulous. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've been in Cambridge for some time now, you may have noticed the gradual disappearance of the old K6 telephone boxes that have been iconic photographic British landmarks since before the 1950s, or indeed the even rarer old-fashioned police boxes. The last small one in Cambridge used to be posited outside what's now Waterstone Books and was either removed in the 1980s or collected secretly by a Time Lord owner. Doctor Who TARDISes have been appearing in all sorts of places recently as a current craze in front gardens and jokey spots, and the old red phone boxes are being bought and used for purposes such as domestic showers. If you'd like to acquire one of them for an arts project, the City Council has just opened the bidding for the K6 phone box currently posited on Quayside because it wants to preserve its heritage after being removed from service next February. If you'd like this local artefact, contact David Fould at cambridge.gov.uk, giving a brief statement of the organisation that you represent and your idea for how the telephone box would be used, and do it by tomorrow's deadline. If you're looking for something a bit different for the family and small children this Halloween, Cambridge Arts Salon is inviting people to do some mildly spooky creative things on October the 27th. Braving bats, cobwebs and rubber spiders, I briefly met artists Jill Fordham, Fiona Henderson and Ruth Schmidt, who created the brand Q Here, which makes designer bags from recycled materials for things like laptops, handbags and personal cases. They introduced the scheme.
This half term we're having a couple of workshops for families to draw and to do some craft work exploring the Halloween themes. Fun family workshops for people to bring their kids to.
Black Cat is a typical Halloween character, I think it's quite a generic character. And we've got an exhibition running at the salon anyway. At the same time, Jo Clark, and she does a lot of animals, so we thought a black cat links in with that. I don't know whether Jo's going to actually be there on the day to help with the workshop, but she might be. But it's certainly on, the exhibition is on, so there's lots of animals in that, but we've turned it into a sort of Halloween theme as well. So the cat is linked up to Halloween. They can go away with a really good drawing of a cat. And then the next thing that they'll do is carving a pumpkin out as well. So they're both things that are really fun to do, really practical and really Halloween-ish theme.
And you're going to exhibit all the work around the gallery afterwards, are you?
Yes.
And there's another event coming up here at Cambridge Arts Salon, which is...
The Upcycle City is because Q Here has always been an upcycling type of brand, because basically from its origins, Q Here would get hold of banners, advertising banners that were being thrown out, save them from landfill and turn them into bags. And the other thing has been getting hold of used cycle inner tubes, tubes that have been punctured. They were also going to be thrown out, and they've been made into bags as well. But the Upcycle City goes a little bit further, because it's sort of spreading further than just bags. We're doing furniture, home decor, and a few other things, quite surprising new things. So it's not just bags anymore. Q here are doing all sorts of things. It's basically the collaboration is between Ruth Schmidt, who is Q here founder, and me, Fiona Henderson. We've been working together and having a lot of fun with it.
And you're actually making bags here, aren't you?
Well, some I make, just I design myself, and then people come and see a bag, and then they either like it as it is, or they said, well, I want it with another colour, another stripe, or another size, and then I custom make them.
Great. So lots of creative things happening at Cambridge Arts Salon and in the near future. Thanks very much indeed for talking to me.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You're listening to Arts Roundup on Cambridge 105.
It's time to take a pick of what's coming up in the city in the next few weeks. The Fairhaven Singers concert season with conductor Ralph Wood continues with Immortal Fire, featuring work by Bach and Purcell, on November the 9th at Queen's College Chapel and on the 10th at St Vigors in Fulbourne. White House Arts presents a charity arts exhibition at Chesterton Community College on Saturday the 16th and 17th of November in aid of SOS Children and Rowan. The Cambridge Corn Exchange presents an evening with Julian Lloyd Webber and musician friends on the 30th of October. There's a poetry reading and talk at the Polar Museum by poet, naturalist and essayist Charles Hood on Wednesday, November the 6th, based on his experiences in Antarctica. The Czech National Symphony Orchestra, under conductor Peter Altischer, performs Schubert, Strauss and Dvorak on Tuesday the 26th of November at the Corn Exchange. And stand-up comedian Greg Davis is at the Corn Exchange, presenting The Back of My Mum's Head on November the 14th. And that's all we have time for in this edition of Arts Roundup. I hope you enjoyed listening in on Cambridge 105, and will let us know if you have a story to tell.